So in the last lecture, we didn't quite get through the full discussion of taxation and the attack on the affirmative state. So I'd like to begin today's session by finishing up Tuesday's. Let me preface the discussion with an attempt to remind you as to why I think this is important. You know, it might seem odd in a sociology course to have a whole lecture on taxation. That doesn't sound exactly like a sociological topic. I suspect most of you understand why I do think it's important, but let me kind of rejigger this a little bit. We live in an economy which distributes income to people in a particular way. So you can make various judgments on that. We discussed those issues in the first part of the course. You can think it's either a good thing or a bad thing that we have lots of inequality. It's a good thing or a bad thing that the distance between the wealthiest and the poorest people of our society is big or small. There's lots of different debates about that. Let's put those aside. Let's forget about the question of whether the basic underlying structure of income that people get to live their lives in the United States, let's just put it aside as to whether we think that's a good or bad thing, fair or unfair, just or unjust. We have a particular income distribution. Then we have another problem to solve, given that income distribution. How are we going to pay for the things which we jointly need to have done as a society? We have to take resources from this privately controlled distribution of income and reallocate some amount of them to public purposes. Now, there are two kinds of really basic issues that come into play here. The first issue is, how should we distribute the burden of that transfer, taking resources out of public consumption and putting them into these collective purposes? So we have to figure out how to do that, how to get those resources. And the second thing we have to figure out is, what are the legitimate things to do? Right? So if you have some things you want to spend that public money on that are completely wasteful and shouldn't be done, you feel that they're illegitimate, then that means it's not legitimate to take any resources from people to put into that collective project, right? The only basis upon which you can transfer resources, the only justified basis of taking resources from people's personal private consumption and using them for collective purposes is if you endorse those collective purposes in the first place. So we have two kinds of debates, and they often get confused. We have a debate as to what's the legitimate purposes of government, and a debate about how much resources to take for those legitimate purposes and how to get them. These are separate issues, but they get confused. Now, a sneaky way, I think, a sneaky way of making it difficult for the government to do all sorts of things which most people might find legitimate is to simply say, we cannot afford it. We cannot afford it because we cannot take more resources from the private and put it into the public. So if you say we can't afford it, then even if there's things that are really good, you say, well, it's just too bad. This life, you can't do it. So let's just take as an example. I think there should be no hungry children in the United States. I think it's part of our collective responsibility as a society to see that no child is cold, has bad shelter, or is hungry. I think that's a legitimate purpose for us to use our collective resources to solve. And we know it can't be solved by markets. And we also know from historical experience it's not adequately solved if it's just left to individual charity. It just isn't. I mean, you could wish it were solved by people just being generous privately. It just isn't solved. I think it's a legitimate public purpose. Some people might think, no, it's not a legitimate public purpose. It's too bad that children are poor and hungry, but I don't have any responsibility. I didn't make them poor. I take care of my children. I shouldn't have to pay anything for that. So that's a debate as to what the legitimate purposes of government would be. And I think that's a legitimate debate. I mean, I have a position on it, but I don't think it's an illegitimate discussion. What are the proper purposes of government? What I do think is illegitimate, however, is to say we can't solve this problem because it's too expensive, because we just can't afford it. That's simply not true. We can solve the problem. We have enormous amount of resources. If we wanted to collectively solve the problem of hunger and shelter and other provisions of basic needs for children, we could do it. But we'd have to tax private resources to get it. So if you say we can't do the tax part, if the tax part is where the obstacle is, then you preclude doing all sorts of things which otherwise most people would find legitimate. I think that's the basic character of our current political impasse. Because there's lots of things that most people like. When you do surveys of people and ask them, do you think everybody should have health insurance with good quality health care? Do you think children should be hungry, so to speak? You know, there's a long list of should we control pollution? Should we have clean air and clean environment? People want all these things. They think it's the legitimate purpose of government. But they also feel there's a budget constraint. And the budget constraint comes because of a belief about taxation. Because beliefs about taxation. Now that's why in the last lecture I was putting so much emphasis on this question of what's the fair system. We clearly are a rich enough country to do it. The question then is, can we get these taxes in a way that's fair? And that's why this issue of equal burden becomes so important. And why I really want you to worry about that question. You know, some ideas take a while to kind of get in your bones, to really get a sensitivity and figure out how it really works. I think this notion of equal burden is not an easy one. It's not a completely straightforward and transparent one, and if you don't get it the first time, by which I mean, of course, understand it as I've laid it out, this is a case where I think my perspective isn't just an opinion. You know, this is a debate one might have about many things I say in the course. Some things are just my perspective on things. Other things, I think, are really the correct way to think about it. I think the ordinary way that people understand what it means for two people to have an equal burden, to make equal sacrifice for some common project, I think that normal, ordinary, intuitive sense that we all share means that tax rates have to be higher on people who have more money. I don't think that an equal burden idea can be properly represented by saying everybody should pay the same tax. Nobody thinks that. Nobody thinks that it's an equal burden for a millionaire and for a poor person to pay $1,000 in tax. But I also don't think the equal percentage idea captures what most people would actually believe is an equal sacrifice. An equal sacrifice is the fair share view of taxation. Equal sacrifice, I think, is the only coherent way to think about how we should distribute the burdens of paying for our collective needs in a society. And that means higher tax rates on people who earn more. That doesn't settle the question of how much higher. That's why we did that little exercise in class where I, you know, quick and dirty statistical study of your views about what's the equivalent of, I forget what it was, $100 paid by a relatively poor person. What's the equivalent for a rich person? But, you know, the class's view is it's sort of 4-5 to 1, the ratio of how much the tax rate should be. That's a pretty steep progressive income tax. Those of you who voted in that middle range of that distribution were all voting for major tax increases on the wealthy in the United States. That's the implication of that vote, that our tax rates are way too low on people who earn hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars a year, that they are not doing their fair share because they're not experiencing the same burden as are people at the lower end of the income distribution. And that problem is a problem once you acknowledge that we have these collective purposes which we have to fund. And that's why this is, I think, a salient issue in understanding how American society works. Okay, let's finish up the stuff that I didn't get to. Myths and realities. I'll do this fairly quickly because this material is covered in the chapters in the book as well. So first, are taxes high in the United States? You would think from the debates that have taken place in the political arena that the United States has competitive problems globally because we are a high tax society. And that is just simply false. That's not just an exaggeration. It is absolutely not true. The United States' tax rate, if you look at the total percentage of our of the national income, gross domestic product, that is taxed in the United States, it's under 30%. It's about 28%. At least this was 2008 data. The tax rates are not higher now than they were in 2008. Roughly, 28%. Denmark and Sweden are close to 50%. Canada, a country pretty much like the United States in a lot of ways, is 33%. Very few countries that are in our economic league have tax rates anything close to what ours are. Ours is a full 10 percentage points less than the average for rich countries. The average for rich countries is 38%. What that means is we could increase taxes overall from all sources, increase it by a full 10% of our economy and just get to the average of rich countries. That would wipe out our deficit would disappear tomorrow. We'd have zero deficit. We'd have a budget surplus under current conditions if we raised our taxes just to the average of rich countries. Now, that might or might not be a good thing. There's all sorts of reasons why one might say raising taxes that much could be damaging. But it isn't by virtue of the fact that we have a high tax regime. We have a low tax regime in the United States. People keep a higher percentage of the income they earn from the market for personal consumption purposes in the U.S. than in virtually any other comparably rich country. Are tax burdens fair in the United States? If we have this basic view, which I think is the proper view to have, that a fair tax system means that the richer you are, the higher proportion of your income goes to taxes. Not the richer you are, you pay more taxes. That isn't sufficient to make it fair. To be fair, the tax rates have to be higher if you're richer. In the election campaign, a big deal was made of the fact that Mitt Romney, in the 1 year of his tax returns that he was willing to release, that he paid less than 15% of his income of $20 million. I think that was his 2010 taxes, I'm not sure which year, some recent year. He paid 13.9% of $20 million, which the kind of political joke was that was a lower rate on his income than his secretary paid. There's no way in the world, I think, that one can describe that as an equal burden principle. If you look at state and local taxes, which are a pretty significant part of total taxation in the United States, it's not just federal taxes. State and local taxes are an important part of our tax system. And ask what percentage of income is paid by the top 1% of households compared to the bottom 20%. So the bottom 20% are really pretty poor in the United States. That includes people who live in households just above the poverty line, but just above the poverty line. I think most people would recognize that if you're in the bottom 20% of the income distribution, you have a pretty tough time making ends meet. Well, you can see that for sales taxes, people at the bottom pay a much higher percentage of their total income in taxes. On property taxes, they pay a much higher income percentage of their income. For income tax, it's true that local and state income taxes, a higher percentage of their income is paid by the top 1% than the bottom 20%. But if you add all these together, the total tax burden on people at the bottom, at the very bottom, is almost twice as much, the burden, as a percentage. Well, this is as a percentage. As a burden, it's way more than twice the burden. A 12% tax rate on the poor is more than two times the burden of a 8% tax rate on the rich. Remember, if you think about the percentages as reflecting the nature of burden, it should be that the rich would be paying 25% of their income, perhaps. Now, I just want to emphasize, it's not a simple matter to know what the proper ratios are. You know, that's not simple. It's just that when it's reversed, when people at the bottom are paying a higher percentage of their income, that's not just not equal burden. It's vastly disproportionate burden on the lives of people at the bottom to pay for the common purposes that we share as members of an interdependent world in a common country. Taxes, I think, are grossly unfair in the United States. And even with all of the proposed tax reforms that are currently on the table, those will hardly make a dent in the degree of unfairness. Even if Obama were to get magically all of the things he wants, that just takes the slight edge off the degree of unfairness in the existing tax structure. Let's turn to the question of the affirmative state and the attack on the affirmative state that has been waged in the United States pretty relentlessly over the past 30 years. Here's the definition of what I'm calling the affirmative state. The affirmative state, that expression, affirmative state, that's not a standard term. That's a term that Joel Rogers and I concocted, basically as a way of describing how we think the relationship between state and society should be properly understood. It's an affirmative state. It's affirming our values. It's intervening in the world in ways to solve our collective problems under democratic conditions. So the affirmative state is meant to capture that positive notion. We prefer it to simply calling it the interventionist state because that doesn't so clearly suggest this positive role. So here's the definition. An affirmative state is a state that provides a wide range of public goods and plays an active role in solving social problems and advancing public purposes. Just to remind you what might go under that heading, here's a nice long list of things. Some of these things are elements of the affirmative state that virtually everybody thinks is legitimate. Very few people say that it's not a responsibility of the state to provide public safety. Lots of people think that there should be no subsidies for the arts. They think that that's not the business of the state. I think, to the contrary, that the arts and recreation are a public good. It makes for a better world, a better kind of society, even for people who don't particularly like the arts. Because I think the arts enrich the nature of the social space in which we live, and that has positive effects even on those people who don't consume them. It's a better world to have symphony orchestras and subsidized venues for rock concerts. That's a better world than one without them, even for people who don't like rock music or symphony orchestras, because it creates a social space of enjoyment and of aesthetic appreciation, which has spillover effects for everybody. Well, these are a partial list of public goods. What I'm referring to as the attack on the affirmative state is basically an attack on the capacity of the state to perform these functions well. Throughout American history, there's been episodes in which the affirmative state has expanded and episodes in which it's come under assault. In the 20th century, the two biggest episodes of the expansion of the affirmative state, that is the affirmative state taking on new responsibilities to solve problems and provide public goods, the two biggest episodes were the 1930s in the New Deal and the 1960s and early 70s in the Great Society. Many of you may not realize that the big expansion of the state, affirmative state, to regulate various aspects and solve various kinds of collective problems that started in the 60s actually included a lot of new programs initiated during the Nixon administration. That was an era in which both Democrats and Republicans recognized the value of an affirmative state. So the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, was a Nixon administration, not a Johnson administration. It was a Republican initiative, the Environmental Protection Agency. So the 60s and the 70s were the last big episode. The current period has seen one breakthrough around the affirmative state, the expansion of the state's role in organizing and solving problems around health insurance. There's a, you know, the Obama health initiatives constitute an advance of the affirmative state. But in other respects, in the last period, the affirmative state has continued to be under attack. There's a three-pronged attack on the affirmative state. So there's three ways that this attack gets organized, three fronts on the battle. First, the attack on the legitimacy of taxation. There's a constant reiteration that that taxation is oppressive, that the government is taking away your money, that taxes are always to be suspect, and the lower the taxes, the better. The most notorious form of the assault on the taxing capacity is the famous anti-tax pledge that Grover Norquist, a extreme conservative political operative in Washington, has pushed, which until recently the Republican Party fully endorsed, in which what Norquist said is that he wants to block all tax increases and continually push for tax cuts in order to, as he puts it, starve government. And to quote him directly, "I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub." Now, of course, he wasn't being serious in his excessive literary attempt at a kind of funny characterization. But what he really was getting at is, if you don't like all these government programs for whatever reason, one way of disabling them is to starve them. The purpose of those big tax cuts, from Grover Norquist's point of view, was to create big deficits, unsustainable deficits. Because once you have unsustainable deficits, and if you block the possibility of raising new revenues, then what's the solution? You have to cut programs. You have to get rid of the public goods that the affirmative state provides. So that's the first attack, line of attack. Let's starve the government, the affirmative state, of the resources necessary to provide public goods, to underwrite higher education and public education, and so on. The second attack is to attack the intentions of government. The constant mantra that big government is corrupt, that government acts in the interests of something called Washington, inside the Beltway, that bureaucrats and not the interests of citizens govern the purposes of government. We must control big spending, tax and spend, as it's often called, because the motivation of spending is just the accumulation of power. So the attacks on the Obama healthcare proposals are, among other things, that the purpose of the proposals is for the government to control your lives. Right? That's one of the characterizations of the healthcare reforms. Why does Obama push for universal health care because it enables the government to control your life, as opposed to solve a problem. Now, there could be criticisms that this is not a good way of solving the problem. It'll create more problems than it solves. You know, there's legitimate grounds for debate. But to impugn the motives of the expansion of health care by saying that its very purpose is just the accumulation of power, because the bureaucrats and politicians and, quote, Washington, have as their driving goal power for the sake of power. That's the second line of attack on the whole idea of the affirmative state. And, you know, if I believed that that were true, I would also be critical of the affirmative state. I would say, much as I would like the state to solve these problems and provide these public goods because I think there's a moral imperative for them, much as I would like that, alas, it's just impossible because whenever you try to do it, you create these monsters who are just interested in the accumulation of power. This is sometimes called the Frankenstein problem. You know, you create with good intentions a state apparatus to solve problems, but it becomes this uncontrollable monster that's only interested in its own power. If that were true, I don't believe it's true, but if it were true, then in spite of my particular values and political perspective, I would have to reluctantly say, we just can't solve these problems. It's beyond human device. We can't solve the problems because every attempt to do so creates a monster. That's the kind of anti-state ideology that I think is the second prong of attack on the affirmative state. The motives are always suspect. If you, for some reason, I'm on the Tea Party's email list, and I decided not to get off of it because it's, I mean, I suppose, I was going to say it's kind of interesting. It's both interesting and frightening what's in some of these emails. But the constant mantra is that the government is, and the liberal forces in the United States, that their only purpose is to dominate and control and oppress. That is what motivates them, as opposed to that they have genuine good faith motives but may not be able to achieve them. Third attack is on the competence of government. Now, this isn't the same as impugning the motives. It's just saying bureaucrats are just incompetent. They just can't solve these problems. The information problems are too great. Government regulations always undermine the purposes for which they are designed. Now, of course, there may be plenty of stupid regulations. I'm not for a moment denying that. There is undoubtedly situations where government rules and regulations are excessive. It's important to note, however, that lots of what's called paperwork and stupid regulations, a lot of them are imposed in order to prevent government abuse. It's to force government agencies to follow the rules. And in order to enforce that the government agencies follow the rules, they have to go through a set of steps. They can't just tell a business, you have to stop polluting in such and such a way. They have to have a procedure, and the procedures means paperwork. So a lot of what's thought of as red tape is actually just pretty sensible control to see that rules and regulations are followed. The question, however, there's no question, it's absolutely true that there are plenty of stupid rules. Any complex system like a government's attempt to regulate and solve problems is going to create mistakes. And those mistakes are often institutionally rigid and not that easy to correct. So there's plenty of examples where people find, where you can identify rules and regulations that are reflecting incompetence. The question is whether the implication of this is to simply indict the very possibility of government regulation, government provision of public goods, or whether the implication of bad regulations is that we need to reform those regulations and improve them in various ways. In any case, the assault on the affirmative state has tried to suggest that the kind of incompetence that's sometimes identified, the sorts of corruption that sometimes does occur, indicts the whole apparatus and provides a justification for pushing back and pulling back on what the government does, rather than simply trying to improve and deepen the sensibleness of whatever rules and regulations there might be. Those are the three basic kinds of strategies. Then there are four kinds of, you know, I like to do these things, right? There's three of this, there's four of that, there's two of this. I hope that doesn't get too tedious sometimes, but those three strategies have been used to produce basically four clusters of very significant changes in the nature of the affirmative state over the last three decades, since the early 1980s, really beginning a little bit in the late 70s as well. First, there's just simply cutbacks in publicly funded programs, less funding for higher education, therefore higher tuition. We call the University of Wisconsin a public university, but you know the percentage of the total budget at the University of Wisconsin that comes out of state taxes is only around 10 or 12%. You have to make up the difference. Your higher tuition rates are one of the ways that we make up the difference. The state has continuously been cutting back the amount of direct subsidy to higher education. The university's only available response is to raise tuition. Tuition should be, I think, thought of as at least in part a form of taxation on the families and individuals who go to universities. Because universities are a public good, and you are paying through your own tuition tax, as it were, for the public good that everybody will benefit from. Less funding for medical research. Dramatic cutbacks in the funding for for basic research. And less funding for things like public housing, job training, and other public goods and programs that serve the interests primarily of people at the lower end of the income distribution. So cutbacks in publicly funded programs, that's one type of change. A second type of change is deregulation. Weaker regulation of certain categories of toxic waste, weaker regulations of logging, for example, weaker regulations of product safety. Lax enforcement. So weaker regulation is one way. That is, you actually change the regulation. Certain things are allowed that weren't previously allowed. You don't regulate where oil companies can drill as much as you did in the past. You don't require as thorough an environmental impact assessment as you did in the past. That's weaker regulation. The other kind of cutback in the undermining of the affirmative state is lax enforcement. You can have the same rules on the books, but then you simply cut back on the number of inspectors. Sometimes this produces pretty serious consequences. There has been a very substantial cutback in the inspection by the Food and Drug Administration of meat, of slaughterhouses. And that's one of the reasons why there have been more episodes of E. coli infections than there were in the past. The recent outbreak of meningitis because of these compounder pharmacies that are not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration is another example. You cut back on food safety and health inspectors in a profit-maximizing system where everyone is competing and trying to cut costs and maximize profits. If you have less inspection to enforce health and safety standards, what's the predictable result? More incidents of problems with food safety and health. That's true for occupational safety and health. The number of inspectors has been dramatically cut in recent years. In the chapter in the book, Joel and I lay out some details on more examples of this, lax enforcement. And finally, privatization. Now, privatization means, that expression, privatization, refers to changes where certain kinds of functions which were previously directly organized by the government are sold off through some kind of bidding process to private entrepreneurs who provide that service as a private corporation. Some of the examples in the United States of this, 30 years ago, would have been unthinkable. 40 years ago, when I was a student your age, and somebody said, what do you think? Do you think in a few years we will have significant numbers of private prisons? People would have thought, what are you talking about? That just is ridiculous. If there's one thing that's a kind of core function of the government, it's the criminal justice system. You know, you impose the law, you have a court system, and then you send people to prison, and that's the government's responsibility to run those prisons. Well, we now have a significant sector of private prisons subcontracted by states and by the federal government to do the business of imprisoning. And you can imagine under which system you're likely to have the greatest control over guards, the highest quality control over how prisoners are treated. Is a profit-maximizing prison likely to produce the most humane and respectful and appropriate forms of enforcing justice? Or do you think a publicly accountable, directly publicly run system of prisons? We've also had a massive privatization of many military functions. The military is no longer a purely government function in the United States. We hire lots of mercenaries. You know, the United States goes to Latin America and hires soldiers of fortune to do military functions under the guise of military subcontracting. And public utilities. It used to be the case that water utilities and other public utilities were mostly owned by municipalities. Subsequently, many of them have been sold off to private companies, and often with significant deterioration of service and increase in costs. The purpose of privatization was to improve efficiency. There was a kind of belief that that the private sector could do things better, more efficiently, more competently, the magic of the market. It just turns out simply not to be, as a general rule, the case. It is not the case that the private subcontractors end up saving the government any money. What it does is it produces higher profits in the private sector and often reduces the quality of service as well. So what's the kind of summing up here? In the last quarter century, there's been a relentless attack on the state's competence to solve problems. The market and private agencies have been endlessly touted as more efficient and effective than government for virtually everything, from running prisons to health and education. Seemingly public institutions like the University of Wisconsin have become effectively quasi-private institutions because of the reduced role of public support for these institutions. The very idea of taxation has been attacked, and taxes repeatedly cut dramatically, particularly for the wealthy. The gut feeling that taxation is fundamentally legitimate and we should kick and scream whenever we're asked to pay taxes has become more the common sense, I think, in the United States than it was in an earlier generation. Huge deficits have nevertheless been created through massive military spending, thus making it even harder to work for a rehabilitation of the ideal of the affirmative state. And the result of all this has been what I would describe as a serious enfeeblement of American democracy. So not only is democracy weak because of the role of money in elections and because of gerrymandering, which produces the results that a majority of the population voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives, and yet we have a strongly Republican House of Representatives. This mismatch between the will of the people and the form of representation. So not only do we have an enfeebled democracy because of institutional failures within democracy itself, within the process of electoral competition, we have an enfeebled democracy because of the erosion of the scope for public collective purposes to be under the control of democratic institutions. Well, that's a sad story. Just so you know, at the very end of the course, I'll try to create some happier stories. There'll be some discussion of new possibilities. Let's move on to the media discussion. I will just reset the recording.